Blog Talk Radio.
The Abolitionist Hour. I'm your host, Carl G. Call in at 646-716-8652. And don't forget to push 1. Broadcasting from the southern plains of the greater Midwest in Kansas City, overlooking the beautiful Kaw River Valley in lovely Wyandotte County, Kansas, and occupied Osage Indian Territory. So greetings, ex-prisoners, partisans, communards, brigadiers, and lumpen proletariat. This is the Prison Abolitionist Hour podcast, celebrating 370 years of anti-capitalist thought through reasoning and rebellion. Greetings, listeners. This is the Abolitionist Hour, the voice of Kansas, on Blog Talk Radio. I'm your host, Carl G. We are now beginning our third year on the Abolitionist Hour, here on the voice of Kansas. We appreciate our listeners and our supporters at the Little Blue Barn, the pamphleteers of the Flying Cock Flyer and Radio Free Kansas, the industrial workers of the world, the Incarcerated Workers Organizing Committee of the IWW. And we appreciate the feedback from our listeners in the inner city of Kansas City, as well as the surrounding metro area, our folks on the east and west coast, and not forget our listeners in southern Alabama. We have a question for our listeners today. Did we ever live in a democracy? Can we get a clear picture of those who steer the rudder of the ship of state from decade to decade? The killing of Cameron Lamb, as thousands of other black and brown bodies, is considered heroic by the law enforcement community. The police union complains about the narrative of the Kansas City Star and why it's not just a routine killing by the Kansas City Police Department. KCMO is saying that Cameron Lamb was in a stolen vehicle with a stolen gun. Car thieves being killed, practically a weekly occurrence in Kansas City. Question is, should car thieves be executed? We're in a situation where there is a national body count with black and brown bodies. More people have been killed by police than have died in wars in the past 50 years. One thing that's changed since the George Floyd uprising is people want transparency and accountability. People are paying attention. How do we reorganize society so that the working class has a fair stake in the game? How many citizens have been targeted by police in the past 4 years? Nationwide, 14,000 have been arrested, more arrests since the Vietnam War movement. We know there's over 15,000 paid police informants on the streets of America. As y'all know, we are a prison abolition podcast. We want all prisons to be torn down. Anyone who confronts the Incarcerated Workers Organizing Committee about these issues with the Kansas City Police Department is pulling at straws. If frontline defenders are so well trained in crime scene investigations, in approaching a hazardous situation, how did this even happen? Shoddy police work somehow proves Detective DeValcare was innocent. The claim of the unreliable witness, not seeing the gun on the stairs, then seeing the gun on the stairs. Forensics at the scene did not follow due diligence and left coins and bullets in Cameron Lamb's pocket. If the 60s were a war on young people, then the 21st century is a war on humanity. We're hearing the old Giuliani broken windows defense as to why they approached Cameron Lamb. In 2014, after the Mike Brown uprising, Kansas City City Hall, under the administration of Mayor Sly Sylvester, funded a police exchange program with the Israeli Defense Force, known as the IDF. Recently, at this time, Missouri Governor Mike Parson is considering a pardon for KCPD Detective Eric DeValcarre. A question that only the Abolitionist Hour is asking. Was Detective DeValcarre trained by the IDF? Do the citizens of the Kansas City Metro have the right to see the list of police officers trained by the Israeli Defense Force? And are these IDF trainers linked to war crimes in Gaza? Will Governor Mike Parson be catfished by the right-wing bloggers and pundits like KCMO AM plea by Madame DeValcarre to spare her husband, like the DOJ did? Madame DeValcarre's bourgeois attempt using everyday racist tropes and binary language used towards criminal defendants, every word except super predator, leading their audience to assume Cameron Lamb stole and painted a hot automobile on the day that Cameron Lamb was killed? Killed by Chief Smith's terror squad, who chose to hunt by helicopter, where DeValcarre had access to live video from the new Kansas City police chopper that cost in the area of $700,000 with state-of-the-art surveillance equipment, allowing patrol cars to virtually see around corners. Killing Cameron Lamb in 10 seconds, a baggie of unknown powder and a scale and a bag of weed is not human trafficking. DNA on the stolen gun, DNA on the bullets, DNA on the magazine, against shoddy police work collecting evidence. This is a situation where everything has gone wrong. The killing of Cameron Lamb is a systems crash. This is the Abolitionist Hour, the voice of Kansas, on Blog Talk Radio. The Jackson County Jail is still planned for construction. The Tristorica of mass incarceration is Joe Moss, Eli Gage, and former Jackson County Judge David M. Byrne, pitchman for the new jail. As we've said before, it's not just a stockade, it's a phone company. But it's not just about building two new jails in Jackson County, one for the police and one for the Sheriff's Department, who point the finger at mismanagement and cost overruns and downright theft. And where is former county executive Mike Sanders? 11 months on a 27-month prison sentence. Sanders is MIA. Is that why the Jackson County legislature is sweating right now? Does Mike Sanders know where the bodies are buried? Then we start out with an activist from Kennebunkport, Maine, explains the housing shortage. A TikTok video of another Black Movement activist with racial equity. Another activist explains support for Palestinian self-determination and how it coincides with support for the Jewish community. Then our major feature from the Hot Tub Time Machine, Iran-Contra Deconstructed by historian Sean Munger. Who is Robert Bud McFarlane, and why did Bud attempt suicide the night before testimony? This is The Voice of Kansas on Blog Talk Radio. The Abolitionist Hour. I'm your host, Carl G. We begin with Noam Chomsky. Chomsky points out modern language is a national language, the mixture of dialect and changes over time.
What determines how language in a particular country evolves? Why is French, for example, so different from German?
Well, first of all, you're assuming the French is different from German, and
the French would probably say so.
You know, there's no simple measure of how different languages are from one another. In fact, if you look at the languages structurally, the way a linguist would look at them, French is different from the other Romance languages in a variety of ways, which make it more similar to German and other Germanic languages. There are a number of features of French which are sort of Germanic in character. All the Romance languages, except for French, you can delete the subject of a sentence. You can say the equivalent of walks to the store, meaning he walks to the store. We can't do that in English, but you can do it in Italian or Spanish. In fact, it's common Romance, goes right back to Latin. French is the only Romance language in which you can't do that. There are quite a number of respects in which French is different from the other Romance languages. Incidentally, Old French, Middle French, say French in the medieval period was not. It was like the other Romance languages. So something happened to it that made it less like the Romance languages and more like the Germanic languages.
How does language change over time? How did 18th century French change compared to 12th century French?
Well, you know, when we talk about language change, that's very misleading. I mean, there is no such thing as a language in French. I mean, up until, say, the turn of the century, You could find people in nearby villages in France who couldn't understand one, virtually could not understand one another. The idea of a national language is a pretty modern phenomenon. It has to do with the rise of nationalism and communication and so on. Or take, say, Italy today or Germany today. I mean, the differences among the things that we call German are enormous, so enormous as to lead to non-mutual intelligibility. You have to learn the national language when you go to school. It's a different language than the one you spoke at home. When we talk about language changing, what's actually happening is that there's some, it's kind of like species changing. There's a mixture of all sorts of dialects, and the mix changes over time, either because of conquest or some political change, or boundaries are drawn in a different place, or some kind of commercial interchange or whatever. The mixture of these things changes over time, and you take a look at it a few centuries apart, it looks like there's a different language. But what happens is that between generations, there are usually small changes having to do with other influences from the outside and so on. And these things are cumulative. Sometimes they lead to pretty dramatic changes. I mean, within a couple of generations, a language can change structurally in quite dramatic ways. And of course, in, say, lexicon, the words of the language, well, that's a different matter altogether. So when technology develops, you get a whole new vocabulary.
But if you were in France in the 12th century and you understood all the nuances of language, could you have predicted how these various languages would have evolved over time?
No, it's totally impossible. I mean,
is it partially random?
It's not so much that it's random. It's not actually random. For all we know, it might be completely deterministic. There's just too many factors involved. It's like, it's like predicting the weather. There's just too many things going on. Human life is a pretty complicated affair, now culture, our cultures are speakers of English can be misled by this. English is relatively homogeneous. You can go a long way in the United States. I just came from Boston, and I understand everybody in Portland and Seattle and so on. But that's not true of most of the world. Most of the world, language areas, language that you can get very different languages pretty close by. And much of the world is what we would call multilingual.
I know. By the way, that proposal about cameras all over the place, you all have a very small community of color. Placing cameras everywhere, that scares your community of color. Guess what? You already have had the Trader Reds guy say the N-word all over the place and say that the cops were on his side. How do the people of color in this community feel safe? I'm sick of hearing people who have second and third and fourth homes over here complaining that we don't need the housing, that we're going to mess with the traffic. Guess what? I'm on the verge of being homeless in a couple of months because I can't afford to pay $1,500, $1,700, $1,800 working for a nonprofit. So please, can we do something for the actual low-income people that live in this community? I'm sick of hearing the wealthy come in here and say all of these things when you're not going to Village Green. Half the kids in Village Green right now are knocking on the other complex's doors because they don't have food in the summertime. So what is the Hyannis Town Council going to do for those people?
To fight racial inequity, you regret giving them that money then for that cause. Because that doesn't make sense to me. Your feelings about the organization can change now, but why would you regret supporting them then for something that we were all organizing around? I also find it so disingenuous to say, hey, we marched with you, now you have to march with us. Coalition building and solidarity doesn't mean that we are going to unequivocally agree with one another on everything all the time. If you don't know how to disagree with the politics coming out of a community without actively recognizing that you still need to fight for their freedom, I don't know what to tell you. You don't understand what collective liberation is. We have to learn how to disagree with one another and still fundamentally recognize that our freedoms are intertwined, that if you're not free, I'm not free. So do I understand why Black folks feel like that sentiment is transactional? Yes, I do. Also, and I feel like this gets lost and it drives me absolutely bananas, but as someone who studies Black and Jewish solidarity for a living, I hate the way it gets framed as Jewish people helping Black people. Absolutely not. It was reciprocal. We were collectively fighting for our shared liberation, okay? Let's get that clear. But this has been and continues to be a pain point between our communities. As early as the late 20th century, Black folks were already starting to identify with the Palestinian struggle. What was the Black and Jewish Alliance was transforming into the Black and Arab Alliance. And it's been around the question of Israel and Zionism.
We live in a serious time. Too much war and crime. Never let them blow your mind.
We live in a serious time. Too much war and crime. Never let them blow your mind.
Yeah, as I do to my brothers, cut the poor. Ooh, ooh. I know we can take it no more. Just a bus in a the city, blood I run for sure.
Yeah, yeah.
The only thing matter to the man, them a the size of them gun, and them no one fit the ghetto youth, them a got gun. The mother and the daughter and the father and the son, all the baby and the breast in the man, them a born. Ooh, yeah.
We living in a serious time.
Too much war and crime. Never let them blow your mind. South Africa down to America, from Baghdad straight down to Canada, from Pakistan to Afghanistan, from Israel until Palestine.
Yeah, yeah.
Be a worldwide, them a fight on ya. The human life don't worth a dime. But over the horizon, I and I see the sign. I pray that one day everything will be fine.
We living in a serious time.
Yeah, yeah.
Too much war and crime.
Too much war and crime.
Let them blow your mind.
Never let them blow your mind.
We living in a serious time.
Too much war and crime. Never let them blow your mind.
Never let them blow your mind.
What's hidden in the dark will come in the light. Ooh, yes. So you gotta be careful what you're doing. Be careful of the friends you're keeping. Cause they can be so deceiving. They could smile at you and kill you while you're sleeping.
We living in a serious time.
Too much war and crime. Never let them blow your mind.
We living in a serious time.
Too much war and crime. Never let them blow your mind. War and crime. Never let them blow your mind.
Never let them blow your mind. We're living in a serious time.
Too much war and crime.
So I'm Black and Jewish, and as you can imagine, I've been closely following everything unfolding in the Middle East over the last week and a half. And as someone who is firmly rooted in both the Black community and Jewish community, I can't help but notice certain pain points, contradictions, areas where we're speaking over and across one another, and I want to illuminate them. I can't bite my tongue anymore. Okay, fellow black folks, y'all didn't think I wasn't going to call y'all out on y'all stuff too, right? Because we're doing it all right here. I'm tired of seeing us transpose a U.S. racial paradigm onto a situation where it does not apply. And by that I mean I'm tired of us framing it as these white colonial people versus these brown oppressed people. Because in many ways that's what it has looked like in the U.S., but that's actually just not an accurate descriptor. It's ahistorical to describe what's transpiring right now through that lens. 60% of the Israeli population is Mizrahi, Sephardic. Obviously, there are black and Jewish people like me, there are Asian Jewish folks, there are Latina Jewish folks. The Jewish community is deeply diverse, and this gets obfuscated and erased because the majority of the Jewish population in the United States is Ashkenazi, so diasporically has, at one point, had roots in Europe, and many of those folks are white appearing. So I think most black Americans assume that all Jewish people are white or are white appearing or are racialized as white, and that's just not true. That is the particular demographic that we have in the United States. And even though a lot of those folks are white appearing, that whiteness has been deeply conditional across time and space. That's a whole other conversation, but just to name, race is a transient and complicated thing. I think what's also been really painful is the overall erasure of Jewish pain. And this definitely isn't exclusive to the black community. I'm seeing this all around, but I'm seeing it in the black community as well. And so I want to address it. I understand centering the voices and lived experiences of Palestinian people right now, particularly when as a community, their story has been pushed to the margins for far too long. And this is really a reckoning moment where we get to truly see and hear them and critique the dehumanization tactics that have been weaponized against them for too long. I understand that impulse. Many Jewish people have a relative or a friend who's in this region of the world who's being directly impacted, right? Even for those of us who are about Palestinian liberation, who are anti-occupation, anti-genocide, all the things, are still experiencing pain right now and fear. I can be about those things and still see protests happening around the world where people are chanting, "Gas the Jews," and be fucking terrified. Like, both of those things can coexist at the same time. And while I understand that the overwhelming majority of people who are about Palestinian liberation don't share those sentiments, just like we're seeing a rise in Islamophobia, we're also seeing a rise in anti-Semitism, and that's going to invoke fear. Please don't get it twisted. I am not telling you to center the voices of Jewish people right now. What I'm saying is that simply acknowledging that Jewish folks are also experiencing this moment viscerally would go a long way. That's it. The way that Tikkun Olam shows up in my life, or the Jewish principle of world repair, that's what it translates to from Hebrew, is that we're all free or none of us are free. And that means I'm fighting for racial equity. That means I'm fighting against Islamophobia. That means I'm fighting against anti-Semitism. And I recognize that all these things have to be eradicated from the face of the planet for us to actualize the kind of world that we all wish to inhabit. What's not clicking about that? Your support for those things should be unconditional. Unconditional, regardless of what an organization says, what individuals say or do. We're all free or none of us are free. And I need y'all to get that.
I was accused of being a conservative for supporting the Jewish community, which I think is kind of hilarious because the only thing I'm conservative about is my water usage because I believe in climate change, which clearly does not make me a conservative. But anyway, that's a different reel. What I really wanted to say is this. Everything is not black and white. Sometimes it's a yes and situation. It is possible to believe in Israel's right to exist and wanting to support the Jewish community, but also want liberation for the Palestinian people. I don't understand why people don't understand this. You can condemn a government and condemn terrorists at the same damn time. And what I don't seem to get is how people are equating the Israeli government with the Jewish community as a whole. That makes no sense to me. So because you have problems with how a leader is running Israel and the decisions that he is making that you don't agree with, you think that every single Jewish person in the entire world deserves to be obliterated? And I've had so many people say to me that they don't understand how I, as a liberal and a black woman, could be supporting the Jewish community when my plight is similar to the Palestinians. Palestinians aren't hated worldwide for who they are. You know who else is hated worldwide for simply being who they are? Black people. This is where my empathy comes from. And the interesting thing about it is that blacks and Jews have been allies since day one. When Jewish people fled Nazi Germany to come to the States, who took them in? HBCUs. We have been allies since day one, and somewhere along the line in social media, that got dismantled somehow. So I'm not going to stop speaking up, but some of you need to go read a damn book.
Oh, yeah, 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 yeah. We are one family. This is the original family tree. All are one. All are the children. No matter which side of the border you're from, we are drink of water. You
look at me, and all that we see is humanity. Not because of your ethnicity or your religious ideology. Don't deny the love for Babylon philosophy. Don't judge me by the shade of my skin.
No, 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 no.
Don't look down on me for the place of my origin. That you don't share. You spending so much on warfare, dropping bombs and you're killing them down there. Well, the ones in the suffering and despair, when they call for mercy, do you hear? Or do we only love those who are near? When we say we love, do we really care? For wealth and power and glory, you poisoning the children slowly. You subdue your brother so lowly, and treat your sister unholy, yet portray yourself so purely. Your judgment is surely.
In 1985 and 86, the United States government sold military-grade weapons to the country of Iran, a sponsor of various terrorist groups, as a ransom for hostages held by some of those same groups that Iran sponsored. Money received from these weapon sales was secretly diverted to fund a covert army, the Contras, that was fighting against the socialist government of Nicaragua. All of these actions were either illegal or contrary to the stated policy of the United States, or both. This is about as concise an explanation as you can make of the Iran-Contra scandal, and by definition, an explanation that short leaves out almost everything important, particularly the very deep questions of why these events happened, what they mean, and why we should try to understand them. Yes, Iran-Contra is hellaciously complicated. Yes, any in-depth explanation of it very quickly starts to resemble the famous wall of crazy meme. This is not just Iran-Contra explained, it'll be, I hope, Iran-Contra deconstructed. Hi, I'm Sean Munger, I'm a PhD historian, and I've done a lot of in-depth historical stuff on this channel, from Byzantine history to ships and nautical subjects to historical analyses of popular movies. In my videos, I always try to provide as much context as possible, get to the bottom of why things happened, as opposed to just what happened. Of the well-known presidential scandals in recent American history, from Watergate to the Clinton-Lewinsky scandal to the events leading up to Donald Trump's first and second impeachments, Iran-Contra is a bit of a sleeper. It's the one that's the hardest to explain and understand, and the one that gets the least attention. Part of that is because it's incredibly complex. I mean, trying to make sense of Iran-Contra is a pretty daunting intellectual puzzle. As a result, it sort of scares people off. but because it tends to confuse the hell out of even the most advanced history students, and it's very time-intensive to teach. Because not a lot of people know much about it, Iran-Contra tends to reflect ideological biases in a way that other presidential scandals don't, or don't as much. Arising at a time that political partisanship and tribalism was really beginning to sharpen and intensify, Iran-Contra is sort of a Rorschach test. What you see in it depends a lot on your political persuasion. To someone for whom Ronald Reagan was an unqualified hero, it's tempting to conclude that Iran-Contra was a nothing burger, a smear job by Democrats to tarnish the Great Gipper, and that Oliver North and John Poindexter were great patriotic Americans who were unfairly pilloried for doing their duty.
Oh.
conversely, to someone for whom Reagan tends to be a villain, it's equally tempting to conclude that Iran-Contra is the final evidence of his perfidy, a crooked deal from start to finish, that he knew everything and covered it all up. Oh, and the same goes for George Bush, too. I mean, George Bush 1, not literally George Bush 2. In any event, I think you can make a case that the Iran-Contra affair is one of the most difficult problems in recent American history. I suggest you find a comfortable place to sit, top up on your beverage of choice, and get ready for a brain buster of a story. Before we even get to arms deals or Swiss bank accounts or secret armies mucking about in Central American rainforests, we've got an unusually large amount of context to get behind us. Our first stop is the Middle East, specifically Tehran, by way of Beirut. This is Beirut, the capital of Lebanon in the early 1970s. Beirut was a beautiful city that was highly welcoming to foreigners. People used to call it the Paris of the Middle East. In 1975, a civil war broke out in Lebanon. Now, if you think Iran-Contra is complex enough, I won't multiply your pain exponentially by trying to explain the origins of the Lebanese civil war. I don't even fully understand it. But suffice it to say, Lebanon was ethnically and religiously diverse, with significant Christian and Muslim communities. It had traditionally been governed by members of the Christian community. But as more and more Palestinians settled in Lebanon, many of them driven out of their homeland by the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, the demographics of Lebanon began to shift. The Lebanese Civil War, which turned the Paris of the Middle East into a blasted hellhole of crumbling rubble, was not fought primarily by organized state armies, but by militias that tended to be ethnically and religiously homogeneous. So you had Christian militias fighting Muslim militias, and you had Sunni Muslim militias and Shia Muslim militias, and militias with various ideologies from rightist to leftist and everywhere in between. It was a huge mess, and the war seemed to go on forever. Let's leave Beirut behind us for now and shift to Tehran, the capital of Iran. In February 1979, Iran's king, the Shah, heavily supported by the United States and a personal friend of President Jimmy Carter, was overthrown in a revolution that brought a hard-lined fundamentalist Islamic government to power in the form of the Ayatollah Khomeini. Khomeini and most of Iran's people were Shia Muslims, just like significant numbers of Muslims in Lebanon. Shia Muslims, whether they lived in Lebanon or Iraq or elsewhere, tended to look toward Khomeini as a spiritual leader. Anyway, the Shah, who as you recall was Jimmy Carter's friend, fled Iran and then came down with a very unfortunate form of cancer, which at that time could only be treated in the United States. Against the counsel of most of his advisors, Carter decided for humanitarian reasons to let the Shah come to the U.S. for medical treatment. This enraged the people of Iran, who had come to see the Shah as an oppressor. In November 1979, a group of these enraged people in Tehran stormed the U.S. Embassy and took a bunch of its employees as hostages. They demanded that Carter send the Shah to Iran to face trial for his crimes against the Iranian people. Carter refused. Though taking the hostages wasn't Khomeini's idea, he backed the radical group that did it, so it effectively became his policy.
Gonna innocent life lost already. It's a bit old.
The hostage crisis dragged on for more than a year. At one point, Carter attempted a military rescue of the hostages, but it failed. In case you're wondering, the Shah's cancer treatment didn't work. He died, but Iran would still not release the hostages. Let's shift now from Tehran to Detroit. Yes, Detroit, as in Michigan. Unfortunately for him, the year that the hostage crisis stretched on through was 1980, the year Jimmy Carter was running for re-election. His opponent was Ronald Reagan, former governor of California, who clinched the Republican nomination in the primaries. The guy who came in a distant second in those primaries was George Bush. Hold that thought, it becomes important later. During the Republican National Convention in July 1980, and it was where Reagan made a world-changing decision. Coming into the convention, Reagan and his campaign people, including his campaign manager, William Casey, had a bizarre idea to offer the vice presidential nomination to former President Gerald Ford, whom Carter had defeated in 1976. A Reagan-Ford ticket they thought would be unbeatable, but the problem was that Ford, who was also staying at this hotel, wanted a lot of concessions from Reagan in exchange for agreeing to be vice president. We don't need to go into all that, but suffice it to say, the deal to get Ford on the ticket fell apart at the last minute, just before Reagan was supposed to announce his vice presidential running mate. Reagan and Casey were so hot on the Ford idea that they had no plan B. When Ford was suddenly out of the running, they had to scramble to find an acceptable vice presidential nominee. In 3 minutes, yes, 3 minutes, Reagan made the snap decision to offer the VP spot to George Bush, the guy who came in second in the primaries. Bush understood that his political career was over if he didn't take the offer. He had no platform to relaunch his career, so he decided to take it. This snap decision, made in 3 minutes in a Detroit high-rise hotel room, changed American and world history. After their coronation at the convention, Reagan and Bush went out campaigning. They pilloried Carter not merely for being weak, but for humiliating America in the eyes of the world by not being able to resolve the hostage crisis. Let's shift back to the Middle East, to Baghdad now, the capital of Iraq. We're in the summer and fall of 1980. The previous year, 1979, Iraq had been taken over by an ambitious party boss and would-be dictator, Saddam Hussein. He was powerful, but his regime was a little shaky at first. Saddam was a Sunni Muslim. The majority of people in Iraq were Shia Muslims. Now, remember how I said that the Ayatollah Khomeini was sort of the unofficial leader of Shia Muslims everywhere, even outside Iran? Well, Saddam was afraid that Iraq's Shia Muslims would be more loyal to Khomeini than to him, partly for this reason. and partly for a complex bundle of other reasons, which we don't need to go into, Saddam Hussein's Iraq provoked a war with Khomeini's Iran in September 1980. This would eventually become the most destructive war of the 20th century, besides the two world wars. In November 1980, Reagan crushed Carter in the presidential election. Carter had quietly been trying to negotiate with Iran to release the hostages. Ultimately, there were 52 Americans held in Tehran. After the election, but before Carter left office, his people managed to negotiate an end to the crisis, using the government of Algeria as an intermediary. The United States ended up unfreezing a bunch of financial assets belonging to Iran. Khomeini, in any event now, had bigger problems to worry about, such as that war with Iraq. However, just as one last gratuitous poke at Carter, Khomeini delayed the release of the American hostages until just after Ronald Reagan had taken the oath of office as President of the United States. In reality, Reagan had nothing to do with the release of the hostages, but Khomeini helped him out with optics that made him look good and which reinforced the appearance of Carter as a hapless wimp.
March down, judge now, and I'll march down, judge down.
You might well get with your fool in his hair, treating people like products on a shelf. The amount of money where you're spending a day can save a country from decay. You are living a luxury, living a life. You want it all for yourself. That day will arrive when you're closing your eyes. Death will bring you no escape. Now you're going to pay the price.
Water flooding on the road when you step out. Jungle of lights in a blackout. And every day another beast drop out. They're taking it all away. Them a broke down Georgetown.
Now, there was a conspiracy theory popular in the early 90s about this called October Surprise. The idea was that officials of the Reagan campaign, in some versions of the story George Bush himself, negotiated supposedly with the government of Iran to delay the release of the hostages until after the 1980 election. These allegations were investigated in the 90s, including by a congressional committee, and no evidence supporting them was found. We have enough real conspiracies in the story of Iran-Contra as it is. I don't think we need to spend much time on the unfounded ones. By 1982, the war had begun to pull in various other factions and countries from outside Lebanon, including the PLO, Palestinian Liberation Organization, which was the chief coordinator of Palestinian resistance to Israeli occupation of the West Bank and Gaza Strip. Confused yet? Syria was also involved. In June 1982, Israel invaded southern Lebanon to try to crush the PLO, which was operating from that area. In response to this, in July 1982, the president of the American University of Beirut, a man named David Dodge, was abducted by terrorists in Beirut. The group that kidnapped him, Islamic Jihad, was a militant Shia organization sponsored by the government of Iran. The idea was to use Dodge, an American, as a hostage to get the Reagan administration to pressure Israel to withdraw from Lebanon. You could say that this crime, the abduction of David Dodge, was the seed of Iran-Contra. Dodge was released about a year later in July 1983, but his abduction was the start of a whole new hostage crisis, a new spin in the endless cycle of terrorism connected to Iran and the Lebanese civil war. In the late summer of 1982, the United States, as well as a few other Western countries, did try to broker a ceasefire between Israel and the PLO in Lebanon. A multinational force comprised of troops from the U.S., Britain, France, and Italy went into Beirut to supervise the withdrawal of PLO forces from Lebanon. This force included about 800 U.S. Marines. On April 18, 1983, Islamic Jihad, that same terrorist group that was holding David Dodge, probably working with another group called Hezbollah, carried out an attack against the U.S. Embassy in Beirut. A suicide truck bomber blew up 63 people, including 17 Americans. This was bad enough, but an even more monstrous attack occurred a few months later. On October 23, 1983, Iranian-sponsored terrorists, again using suicide truck bombs, blew up two barracks buildings containing U.S. Marines and French troops. The French suffered 58 casualties, the Americans 241.
Well, this one dedicated to all of the freedom fighters. So all of us come and see good blood. Lord have mercy. Come follow me. I'll go. See good. Me ball walk, walk, walk. This a freedom walk. Come on, everybody know the freedom walk. Get on walk, walk, walk. This a freedom walk. Come on, everybody know the freedom walk. Now them take us from the wonderful land of Africa. Them brought us to slave down in Jamaica. And them cast them come America, call them Buffalo Soldier. Come listen to my confess and him a dashing. Oh, I'm a ball walk, walk, walk. Freedom walk. Come on everybody do the freedom walk. Take it down, walk, walk, walk. Take a freedom walk. Come on everybody do the freedom walk. Now them rob us for diamond, gold and silver. Not to mention what they did to our ancestor. Oh, them kill off me brother, kill off me father. Rip off me sister, rip off me mother. That them a go to the area, him a dashing. In a time like now, you have to know about Jaja. Control lightning, control thunder. The wicked we are going to break up their bands asunder. Dirty nigga are going to slide drop down in the gutter. Fire! In a Mount Zion, them can't enter. Come listen to them, I'm going to teach you culture. Walk, 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 Mr. Freedom Walk. Come on, everybody, know the freedom walk. Sit down, walk, walk, walk. Freedom Walk. Come on, everybody, know the freedom walk. In I'm an intention to be a leader. You know, say that the Marcus is not no follower. Oh, I would have rather. I would have rather, but a man I would have, hey, I would have rather, but a man I would have rather, I'd rather, but a man I would have rather be a leader than to be a follower. Motivate time and brother, motivate the sister. In a time like now, we have to know about Jaja. Control lightning, control thunder. The wicked, we are going to break up their bands of thunder. Hey, study more, because I teach you culture, me, but walk, 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 it's a freedom walk. Come on, everybody, do the freedom walk. Take it down, walk, walk.
The Reagan administration's response to these attacks was incoherent for reasons I'll get into in the next chapter. Despite talking tough about not being pushed around by terrorists, there was no coordinated retaliation. Although in December 1983, the battleship USS New Jersey, which was parked offshore, fired some shells at neighborhoods in Beirut where terrorists believed to be associated with those who did the bombing were thought to have their headquarters. Also, in December 1983, Iranian-sponsored terrorists staged another coordinated attack, this time in Kuwait City, believed to be retaliation for the United States and Kuwait supporting Iraq in the Iran-Iraq War. This bombing didn't kill a lot of people. Some of the explosives failed to go off, and the targeting was faulty, but the incident was to have a huge effect down the road. One of the groups that claimed responsibility for this attack was called the Islamic Dawah Party. After the December 83 attacks, Kuwait conducted a dragnet and rounded up a bunch of terrorists associated with this group. 17 of them went to prison for a long, long time. They were known as the Al-Dawah prisoners. In 1984, Hezbollah, another group believed to be Iranian-sponsored, began taking more Americans hostage in Beirut, and they demanded the release of those Al-Dawah prisoners as ransom. This was not the only demand made by the hostage-taking groups, but it was one that kept coming up. For example, Terry Anderson, an Associated Press reporter kidnapped in March 1985, was told that he was being held for the ransom of the Al-Dawah prisoners. By the middle of 1985, Ronald Reagan was facing a protracted hostage crisis involving Iran that was very similar to the one that had haunted Jimmy Carter, and that Reagan himself had used as a political tool to defeat Jimmy Carter in 1980.
Ja! For say life is an illusion. Tell me what you're thinking, I'll provide a conclusion. Watch war on TV.
The Reagan administration's stated policy was not to negotiate with terrorists. They didn't really have a lot of options on how to deal with this. On June 14, 1985, a TWA 727 jet on a long-haul trip from Cairo to Los Angeles was hijacked in midair, shortly after making a stop at Athens, Greece. It's not entirely clear who the perps were this time. Probably Hezbollah, but not a slam dunk. The terrorists killed one American, a U.S. Navy enlisted man named Robert Steedham, and they dumped his body out of the plane onto the runway. This iconic image, one of the most famous of the 1980s, resulted from this attack, where one of the terrorists held a gun to the head of the TWA pilot during his conversation with news media. The terrorists demanded the release of hundreds of prisoners across the Middle East, including the Al-Dawah prisoners, as well as many others being held by Israel. After leapfrogging to various airports around the region for 2 weeks, the TWA hostages were eventually released on June 30th. Israel had indeed begun to free many of the prisoners that the hijackers demanded, but Reagan administration officials assiduously denied that they had pressured Israel to do it, even though they sort of did. Even after the TWA passengers were safe, though, there were at that time 7 Americans being held by Iranian-sponsored groups in Lebanon. The cycle of terrorism brought the issue of hostages to the forefront of Reagan's foreign policy. Between the seizure of multiple hostages, the TWA hijacking, and emotional meetings between Reagan and the families of the hostages, by mid-1985, the hostage issue was at the top of Reagan's priority list. This was to set the stage for the Iran-Contra affair.
I'll walk, I'll talk, but I'm not crawl on my belly like a reptile. Jano, I'll walk, I'll talk, but I'm not crawl on my belly like a reptile. Going to Miami via Vancouver, coming from Jamaica. Bang, ding, dong, ding, ding, ding. I was on the outside for some reason, they won't let me enter. I went to the border, they say my passport was not in order. And so, 7 of us got back on the bus, felt like a loser. We rent some rooms, we got some food, I'm high a dreamer. I went to some club, they were playing reggae rap and blues. I know I'm a winner, but this time they say I'm a loser. But I say, hey, but I say, hey.
Harder, harder, get across the border. Ain't no giant. Trying harder, harder, get across the border. They hit the I-95. foot and not crawl on my belly like a reptile.
Before we get there, we have to take a brief look at what was going on inside Reagan's White House, and even a little bit farther back than that, to Reagan's origins in state politics in California. Ronald Reagan was a B-list movie actor in the golden age of Hollywood before he turned to politics in the mid-1960s. Elected governor of California in 1966, his appeal was based largely on what today we would call culture war issues, standing against the political and social changes sweeping America in the late 1960s. Reagan particularly hated college protesters against the Vietnam War. His election as president in 1980 is often seen as a conservative reaction to the turmoil of the 1960s and 70s. Because his background was in state politics and his main focus were identity and cultural issues, Reagan wasn't very well versed in foreign policy. What opinions he had about foreign affairs in 1980 centered primarily around communism and the Soviet Union. He wanted to take a hard line against them, and a centerpiece of his first term agenda was greatly increased defense spending to counter Soviet and communist bloc military power, particularly in Europe. Beyond this, though, Reagan really didn't have that many thoughts on foreign policy, and it was not destined to be the strong suit of his administration, as he constructed it when he got into office in 1981. There was a very simple reason for this. Reagan chose as his Secretary of State, George Shultz, who had been a minor cabinet official under Richard Nixon. He chose as Secretary of Defense, Caspar Weinberger, who had also been in the Nixon cabinet, and who'd come up in California politics at the same time that Reagan was making his mark. The problem was that these two guys, Shultz and Weinberger, were exact opposites. They disagreed on almost everything, and they hated each other personally. The result in the Reagan cabinet was paralysis, because Shultz typically wanted to do something, and Weinberger usually wanted to do the opposite. Reagan typically avoided making a decision that would piss off either one of them, and thus he just didn't do anything.
Praise is to the king. It's always, always been. Praise is to the king. It's always, always been. Jah is within me, within you too. Yeah. Ancient in my spirit too. You know this ain't nothing new. Mysticism in the moon. Mommy feel it in the womb. Knowledge left for yesterday. Wisdom in the hurricane. Blessings are gonna come in rain. Sun of ego shine, shine. And you know that it's ancient in the spirit too. You know this ain't nothing new. Mysticism in the moon. Mommy feel it in the womb. Knowledge left for yesterday, yeah. Wisdom in the hurricane. Blessings are gonna come in rain. Sun a figure shine. Things have a way to repeat. Deja vu when you feel it. Open your heart to receive. No, open your mouth for no reason. Oh, as the war still awaits. People still stuck in their cages. Imagine the cause of your rage. History remove you from pages. Well, without African unity, then the world could never free. And so said his majesty. Anywhere we walk, walk. Well, you know, it's ancient in the spirit too. You know, nothing say nothing new. Mysticism in the moon. Mommy feel it in the womb. Knowledge that be yesterday, yeah. Wisdom in the hurricane. Blessings are gonna come in rain. Sun a figure shine, shine. Feel the sun up on my face. Happy one of God's many graces. And you know see the wind carry many secrets. If you're listening, then it will reveal it. And you know quiet is so underrated. Something so useful, but without the wisdom you will turn a fool to so balance it. I wonder if I live to see love in the community, liberated and we free. Anywhere we walk.
Case in point, retaliation for the Marine barracks bombing. Shultz wanted a strong retaliation. Weinberger argued against it. Reagan's solution to have the USS New Jersey fire a couple of shells at Beirut was a lame attempt to split the difference, and it didn't work. Reagan was not fond of confrontation. He also wasn't very hands-on. He delegated almost everything. As a result, his advisors, when they needed a decision from the president, carefully controlled the information that he was exposed to and presented him with a limited menu of options to choose from. For most of Reagan's first term, three advisors in particular effectively gated access to President Reagan. These were his chief of staff, James Baker, deputy chief of staff, Michael Deaver, and Ed Meese, counselor to the president, later attorney general. In fact, these three together were known informally as the Troika. But then in early 1985, there was a change at the White House. Donald Regan, Secretary of the Treasury, yes, I realize how confusing it is to have a Donald Regan and a Ronald Reagan in the same White House. Anyway, Donald Regan decided to switch jobs with James Baker. Baker, who was chief of staff, was getting burnt out. By all accounts, Regan was somewhat power-hungry. The switch, which was not Ronald Reagan's idea, occurred in January 1985. The age of the troika controlling access and information that flowed to President Reagan was over. Now, after January 1985, everything went through Chief of Staff Donald Reagan. Reagan, who had been the chairman of Wall Street firm Merrill Lynch before coming to government, knew bupkis about foreign policy. He relied principally on the president's national security advisor, Robert McFarlane, to handle everything related to foreign affairs. Reagan was also being manipulated from an entirely different angle. He listened a lot to his wife, Nancy Reagan, who exerted a tremendous amount of control behind the scenes of the White House. Nancy had her own chief advisor, a celebrity astrologer named Joan Quigley, whom she consulted frequently. Quigley would look into the stars and tell Mrs. Reagan which days were quote-unquote favorable for her husband to make big policy decisions. Quigley's influence on the Reagan White House was kept a carefully guarded secret for years. Now, if this all sounds nuts, it should. Reagan knew about the astrologer, but he couldn't do anything about it. His boss listened to his wife, and she listened to Joan. Reagan was intent on controlling access to the president, mainly so he could manipulate the decisions that were being made. If anything got done in terms of foreign policy, it wasn't because any sort of formal decision got made. The logjam between Shultz and Weinberger typically prevented that, but it would be because Robert McFarlane, the national security advisor, would make an end run around them and get the president to do what he, McFarlane, wanted.
Fight for your right.
In short, the Reagan White House, by the middle of 1985, was a pretty dangerous place, where good policy decision-making processes went to die. If you're getting the impression that the Iran-Contra affair is going to involve Ronald Reagan's advisors doing stuff behind his back without telling him, and then backstabbing each other to get a bigger piece of the action, you're absolutely right. That is exactly where this is going. Before we get to the arms deals, let's delve into one final piece of context. That requires a rather radical shift of venue, from Washington, D.C. to the rainforests of Central America, specifically Nicaragua, by way, rhetorically speaking, of Southeast Asia. When American involvement in the Vietnam War was ramping up, he was also a staunch Cold Warrior and anti-communist. His central obsession was the very old Cold War idea that the Soviet Union was a giant octopus, extending its tentacles everywhere it could in the world and ultimately trying to foment a world socialist revolution. This kind of thinking, straight out of the 1950s, was the main assumption that led the United States into Vietnam. You may have heard of the domino theory. This was the idea that if one country in Southeast Asia turned communist, eventually all of them would. This idea justified vast expenditures of blood and treasure to prevent U.S. ally South Vietnam from uniting with communist North Vietnam. Let's shift now to Central America. Even before the Cold War, this region had long been a playground for U.S. governments and business interests to throw their weight around, and the fight against communism, post-1945, made that tendency even worse. Whenever it looked like a left-wing or even left-leaning regime might come to power in any South or Central American country, the United States got very, very nervous. Cuba, after all, had become a Soviet client state after a leftist revolution overthrew the U.S.-backed government there in 1959. If you believed in domino theory in Southeast Asia, chances are pretty good that you believe the same thing applied in Central America, too. This was why Ronald Reagan was really scared of what happened in Nicaragua. In 1979, after a revolution and a bloody civil war, a party called the FSLN came to power in Nicaragua. The FSLN was a socialist party, commonly called the Sandinistas, named after a guerrilla hero who died in the 1930s, and they revolted against the right-wing government of Anastasio Somoza, who had been backed by the U.S. until Carter ended his support for him. Leftist guerrillas fighting right-wing governments, often backed by the U.S., was a common thing in Central America. It was also happening in El Salvador, going through its own bloody civil war, and also Guatemala. The CIA was deeply involved in these countries, often running covert operations to disrupt the leftist guerrilla factions. American policymakers tended to see Central America as black and white, democracy versus communism, that kind of Cold War struggle, thereby missing all the nuance of what was really going on.
The dragon gets you. Rise up, trample the dragon pit. The dragon. It is time now for the people of the United States to unite with President Reagan to reverse the trends in Central America. Will you back President Reagan and make your voice heard for peace through strength by signing this resolution?
When Reagan came to power in 1981, he was alarmed at the Sandinista regime in Nicaragua. A strong believer in domino theory, Reagan desperately wanted to take the Sandinistas out to prevent, as he saw it, all of Central America eventually going communist. But Congress, controlled by Democrats, who by 1981 generally didn't believe in domino theory anymore, didn't see it that way. When the FSLN, the Sandinistas, flipped Nicaragua in 1979, the opposition to them became the guerrilla force within that country. They were known as the Contras, but they weren't that unified. In fact, there were three major factions within the Contras that were constantly squabbling with each other. In 1981, the CIA started supplying weapons to the Contras and helped them run covert operations against the Sandinista government. Predictably, they did not tell Congress about any of these operations. The head of the CIA under Reagan was William Casey, the same guy who had managed his 1980 campaign and who was involved in the botched effort to get Ford on the ticket. A veteran of World War II espionage operations, Casey was himself an unreconstructed Cold Warrior who wanted to take a hard line against communism and thought Congress and the democratic process just gummed up the works. And Casey loved covert operations. In 1982, the Democratic-controlled Congress, afraid that the Reagan administration and the CIA were going to get the U.S. pulled into another Vietnam-style quagmire, passed a law officially banning the United States from giving military aid to the Contras. This law was popularly known as the Boland Amendment. Fear of another Vietnam wasn't the only motivating factor. The Contras themselves were, in fact, pretty horrible, routinely assassinating civilians, including priests and healthcare workers, engaging in torture, and committing numerous human rights violations. The Reagan administration, like most U.S. administrations, turned a blind eye to these abuses because it thought that the ends justified the means. Preventing communism from taking over Central America was, to them, worth the carnage, a rather cynical view. Reagan was incensed that Congress had cut off military aid to the Contras. He really, really wanted to keep backing them. In fact, this was his pet cause. Advisors said that mere mention of the Contras caused Reagan to, quote, go bananas. With the U.S. government, and particularly the CIA, banned from helping them, enterprising officials in Reagan's government started to think up new ways to keep the lifeline going for Reagan's pet cause. One of the ways they did this was to get other countries to give money to the Contras on the unspoken assumption that this would buy favorable treatment from Ronald Reagan. For example, in early 1985, Robert McFarlane got the government of Saudi Arabia to donate $24 million to the Contras. Officials also hit up wealthy private citizens in the United States and directed those funds secretly to the Contras. The chief official in charge of doing this sort of thing was a Marine Lieutenant Colonel named Oliver North. A Vietnam veteran who predictably felt the U.S. effort in that war had been sabotaged by liberals at home, North had a lot of baggage left over from that conflict. Though still a Marine, he went to work for the National Security Agency in 1981. There, he was involved in various covert operations. We're still not sure exactly what, because they were, of course, covert, and also because North had a tendency to exaggerate his accomplishments, for example, embellishing his role in the 1983 U.S. invasion of the small Caribbean island of Grenada. Concerning Nicaragua, North's job was basically to run and fund a secret war on behalf of the Contras, a war that the U.S. government was technically prohibited legally from supporting. Just so you know, North was not doing this entirely on his own. He was an employee of the National Security Agency, an organization run out of the White House, not accountable directly to Congress or any cabinet-level agency. North's direct boss was Admiral John Poindexter, the deputy national security advisor. His boss was Robert McFarlane, who reported directly to President Reagan. At this time, 1985, there's no evidence that Ronald Reagan even knew who Oliver North was. Oh, I should mention something else because, you guessed it, it becomes important later. All these National Security Agency guys are communicating with each other via computer on a brand new system of interlinked systems called PROFS, or Professional Office System. Basically, email. The whole concept of email was brand new in 1985, and the National Security Agency was using it because they thought it was super secure. Foreshadowing? Anyway, back to Oliver North. When it came to the Contras, North was in charge of sending privately raised funds to them and then helping them buy the stuff they needed. Fancy toys like helicopters and missiles, and then basic stuff like bullets and rifles and uniforms. North's little scheme went by a couple of names, such as The Enterprise and also Project Democracy. It had secret Swiss bank accounts to shift money around without being noticed. North was also able to use, off the record of course, CIA tools to get the stuff he needed to the Contras. Example, the CIA had its own private airline called Southern Air Transport to operate as secret flights into Central America from various points of origin, often dropping pallets of weapons or supplies for the Contras that had been purchased by Project Democracy. A man named Richard Secord, a former Air Force officer with extensive experience in covert operations, and his business partner, Albert Hakim, were involved in these logistics. So, you got all this? A secret war in Central America, officially illegal, funded off the books, run by NSA personnel, including Oliver North, occasionally borrowing CIA assets to make it all work. What could possibly go wrong? Now, finally, after all this context, we get to the arms deals. That's the next chapter.
While many celebrated Lenin as a hero of progressive ideals, others demonized him as a traitor, a disruptor of the status quo, and a threat to the establishment. This dichotomy intensified the perception of Lenin not just as a musician, but as a polarizing figure who commanded attention far beyond his tunes. It was a risky rebranding, moving from the universally loved Beatle to an outspoken activist, and it marked him as a man not just to be listened to, but in the eyes of some, to be silenced. Lenin was not naive. He knew that he was rattling cages. The FBI had him under surveillance, and there were even efforts to have him deported from the United States. Lenin was becoming a symbol of an anti-establishment ethos that many felt was tearing at the fabric of American society. As with figures who stand at the intersection of art and politics, like Bob Dylan or Joan Baez, Lenin's messages reached hearts, but also stepped on toes. Yet, unlike others, he seemed not to waver in the face of criticism. He was Lenin, always candid, always raw. December 8, 1980 began as an ordinary day for John Lenin. Yet, as he returned to the Dakota, his Manhattan residence, that evening, the air seemed to carry an electric charge, a tension that words can hardly capture. He was accompanied by Yoko Ono, his wife and artistic companion. They had spent the day at a photo shoot and were returning home, perhaps expecting nothing more than a quiet evening together. But that tranquility would be shattered irrevocably. Why? Yet, no answer, no matter how well argued or deeply pondered, can bring back the man who once implored us to imagine all the people living life in peace. And perhaps that's the most tragic truth of all.
Everyone is fascinated by psychopathy and by psychopaths. Everyone is fascinated by this overflow of the human psyche that results in repulsive acts. It is sometimes said, accurately I believe, that around 60 or 70% of our problems are caused by 1% of the population. Meaning, 1% is made up of psychopaths, whether on an economic level, a sexual level, or a societal level. There's always a psychopath at work somewhere in the background. This 1% is made up mostly of males. Some writers even talk of 9 men to 1 woman.
What pretty much all psychopaths have in common is that they will always seek power. You can tell when someone is looking for power, looking to gain influence over you, to control you, manipulate you, to feed a need. Maybe they take advantage of you financially or on a sexual level. We feel we're a sexual object for them. When they don't get what they want, they put us down. They humiliate us.
The psychopaths are among us. And the more knowledge we have and the more we wake up and smell the coffee as it comes to the psychopath, we will be able to protect ourselves and our family. When you understand that this is a person who has emotion, a lot of people say, oh, a psychopath has no emotion. That's wrong. They have a lot of emotion. just not for you. Motion is all about me, right?
For all psychopaths, there is this absence of emotional empathy. But they have cognitive empathy, which means they know what you're thinking. They don't feel what you're thinking. What you'd say is a good person would use that knowledge to help you. I understand your problem, and now I'm going to help you solve that problem when I can. But I'm not crying listening to your story. And people with personality disorders that are dangerous, narcissistic personality disorder, also has this lack of emotional empathy that with other traits then becomes pernicious and predatory.
Yes, obviously the psychopath is grappling with a strange psychological condition. He's not a madman. He doesn't talk gibberish. He's not raving. His causality is completely intact. He has both feet on the ground. He just doesn't care about anyone else. Much more than that, he exploits others, either for profit or, more likely, for pleasure.
Put on Thy war up. Sing it loud. Into the Romeo Foxtrot, shall we dance?
Is calling for resettling Palestinians in the U.S. Here's why that should be rejected. The Biden administration has been the arsonist that burned down our humanitarian border and immigration system. Consequently, America now faces growing terrorist threats within our homeland. The Afghan evacuees the Biden administration flew directly to the U.S. after recklessly withdrawing from Afghanistan proves that. We can't vet a population against a database that doesn't exist from a Hamas leadership with which the U.S. neither has diplomatic relations nor trust. The many sizable pro-Hamas demonstrations in the U.S. in the past week have shown us that the Palestinian population has no interest in assimilating into American culture and governance or in expressing loyalty to America or our allies. To import a population of Palestinians would be certain suicide for America.
L'Éternel est mon berger, je ne manquerai de rien, il me fait reposer dans de verts pâturages, il me dirige près des eaux paisibles, il restaure mon âme. Il me conduit dans les sentiers de la justice. À cause de son nom, à cause de son nom. Et quand je marche dans la vallée, dans l'ombre de la mort, je ne crains aucun mal, car tu es avec moi. Je ne crains aucun mal, car vous êtes avec moi. Baruch Ata Adonai. Baruch Abba Yerushalayim. Baruch.
Adonai. Baruch Shema. Baruch Abba Yerushalayim.
Quran, a revelation in Jerusalem. Shalom, salam aleikum. You can see Christian, Jews and Muslim living together and praying, amen. Let's give thanks and praises. Baruch atah Adonai. Jerusalem, Baruch Atah Adonai, Baruch Atah Jerusalem. Jerusalem, here I am. Jerusalem, je t'aime, je t'aime, je t'aime. Christian, Jews and Muslims living together and praying, amen. Let's give thanks and praise. Baruch Atah Adonai. Baruch Abba Yerushalayim. Baruch Atah Adonai. Je t'aime, je t'aime, je t'aime. Jérusalem, here I am. Jérusalem, je t'aime. Israël, I am Jirati. Israël, I am Jirati. Israel, Yakirati. Israel, Yakirati. Israel, Yakirati. Ani, Oevota. Yakirati. Jerusalem, here I am. Jerusalem.
One person can inflict so much pain, suffering, and destruction in their wake, all because no one was brave enough to stop them. This demonstrates the importance of rigid checks and balances to ensure that a person is never given too much power. Sadly, still in the modern day, we see examples of this system failing to do its moral duty. As a consequence, millions of lives have been shattered. When will we ever learn? Rise like lions after slumber in unvanquishable number. Shake your chains to earth like dew which in sleep had fallen on you. Ye are many, they are few. Percy Bysshe Shelley.